interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I liked Al Branstad. He was here for years in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
He was always so nice. Now he's feeling much better. He's got two new hip joints, plastic hip joints.
Oh, right? Is
that right?
For a while there, I saw him when he was humped over with a cane, clear over like this.
Hmm.
He says, "Don't help me. I'll make it. I'll make it." And boy, it was a pitiful sight. And then when we came up with the new airplane a while ago, two, 3 months ago, the new 737.
Mm-hmm.
So Ada and I rode up. There were about 70 freeloaders that came up with the flight. And Al Bramstead was out there on the ramp with the rest of the people to meet us. And the first thing he said, "No, see how I'm walking?" And he was strutting straight up, doing just fine now. He went back to Rochester, Minnesota, and had these plastic joints put in. They're doing that in Seattle, too, of course.
My dad had this hip operation performed in the Tacoma. It's not the Tacoma Hospital, out in Lakewood Center. There's a small hospital in Lakewood Center. But one of the pioneering specialists happens to be there in Lakewood Center out of Tacoma. And my dad had the operation. My dad, shortly after, had a heart attack. He had a bad heart problem. And he's not with us today, but for the other reason. But the hip operation itself was a success. He was up and walking, and as the doctor said, at least when he did pass away, he was full of optimism, and he had a woman doctor as well as a man doctor, and he was planning to go dancing with his lady doctor. So he was free of pain, you know.
Free of pain.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Oh, that's wonderful. Ada has terrible pains continually. She has to dope up with pills all the time, pain-killing kind of pills. Both hips are bad now, and she has a chunk of calcium on her spine right near the sacroiliac joint. And all the doctors, six of them in Seattle, and in Seattle, have said, "Oh, you have an old break there." And she says, "Yes, I slipped down a slope digging clams at Westport." "Oh, no," says, "it's a lot longer than that. You were a young person when you had that break." Now, two doctors told her exactly the same thing without knowing what each one said. And the x-ray show this awful little, almost like a walnut, buildup of calcium. And they don't dare to operate on that because it's at a nerve center and might paralyze her from the hips and down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to touch it. But the plastic hips, now, she could have done. But she hasn't done anything yet. But she gets along pretty well. It's hard for her to sit. She has to sit on a high chair. And, so she can wiggle and straight up.
Yeah.
She can't sit down this low.
I know. I have a problem with this, too. I have a little back problem, and I have all these pillows around to prop myself with. But fortunately, I don't think mine is arthritis-related, although it's related to a fall.
Yeah.
Mr. Wien, tell me, you I was interested in knowing... I'm going to get this thing going over here.
Oh.
Get the thing.
Uh-huh.
Would you tell me, so many people who interview you inquire about your first events, but I'm interested in what happened in your thinking. I've never heard discussed the ideas, the feelings you had about aviation that led to your early pioneering in the field.
Oh, my interest in flying.
Yes.
And why I did it. Well, during First World War, I was 15, 16 when it started. I was 18 when it ended, and I was in the last draft of First World War. But we had the Duluth News Tribune paper daily, and in it, of course, was all the news of the war and all the flying and the aces. Bishop Rickenbacker, a number of others, famous pilots. Well, even before the war, I was interested in flying. What little I could read there on the farm in northern Minnesota, I just in my blood, somehow, I was going to learn to fly. And my four brothers, well, they weren't too interested. They didn't have that drive for flying that I had. My older brother, Ralph, who was killed in Kotzebue in that diesel Blanc experimental plane, he was 16 months older than I was, and he said, well, you never can tell. You might become a great pilot someday. Long before I even got to near an airplane or to touch an airplane, I had to learn to fly. I remember that statement he made.
Yeah. Prophetic.
Yes. So he had faith in what I was thinking and talking about. With the other two younger ones who are here today, Sig and Fritz, they both live in Fairbanks. They were younger, of course, and they never said much about flying. Fritz learned to fly and had between 40 and 50 hours flying here in Fairbanks on a Waco 9 OX5 engine. But somehow he didn't have the drive to keep it up, to continue flying. So he was a good mechanic and stayed with the mechanical end. And when he got married, it cost money and he couldn't get going flying, even if he'd wanted to, I guess. But Sig was a bachelor, and he still is. He went right at it and learned to fly and got his commercial in 1937, and then went to Nome almost right away for our base of operations there. And he put in more hours in the Arctic from Nome, Kotzebue to Barrow, and east to Barrow, than any other person. So he built up a lot of hours, about 12,000 hours total. How many years, I won't remember. Well, it's since 37 up to about 1960, somewhere in there. So if you fly a lot, and he had no wife to come home to, so he practically lived in his airplane.
Yes.
And he was always out at some base or some roadhouse somewhere, ready to fly when the weather cleared. So he, I think, caught up and beat me a little bit. I have 11,900 and something.
Have you really? Nearly 12,000 hours.
Yes, uh-huh. But my son, Merrill, who's flying the jets now, has 23,000 or something, just about double. Mm-hmm. Because it's steady.
Yeah, every month.
Every day. And he put in 5 years in the military, Air Force, too, and did a lot of flying there. The C-119s.
Well, going back to this first airplane that you got put together in Anchorage, what kind of problems had you tried to get other airplanes?
Well, there were no other airplanes for this country or that you could buy at a reasonable price. There were no cabin planes, there were no air-cooled engine airplanes available at all. The Hisso standard had been well proven in flying circus work and such, and at altitude. We were flying Hisso standards in the flying circus 22 and 23, 1923, clear through the Rocky Mountains. Most of the landings were at 4,500 Lake Montana, Great Falls, and on south to Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is 4,500 feet altitude. And Reno, that's about the same, maybe closer to 5,000 feet. Flew on through into California. So we had that experience with the HISO standards. And I didn't have anything to do with the buying of them. Jimmy Rodebaugh, railroad conductor here at Fairbanks, started this part of it. But of course, the year before, some businessmen in Fairbanks had bought an OX-5 Jenny. That's a different airplane entirely, and low power. OX-5, 90 horsepower, and HISO is 150 horsepower. That is the HISO A. Then the HISO E is 180 horsepower. Then the geared HISO 220 horsepower. But we didn't use them, just 150. And that made a performing fool out of a HISO, out of standard,
mm-hmm.
where it was originally designed for the OX-5 90 horsepower. But that made a perfect airplane. It had big wings and it's structurally safe for a bigger engine. It was perfect setup. You couldn't have gotten a better airplane for this country for that time when they hadn't built any fields around, well, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Circle Hot Springs were built. Well, Fairbanks was the racetrack, had been here for some time. Eielson used it the year before, and Frank V. Martin in 1913 set up his Curtis tractor biplane here and flew it just around the town a little bit. Well, they hired him to come in, and he was paid a certain amount for the exhibition. But the city of Fairbanks didn't make much of him because people didn't
They didn't
come
have
out
to go anywhere to see him. They could see him from anywhere.
Yes, many streets back, you mm-hmm. see, they could see him. So they didn't come out and pay their tuition or their tickets out to the airport at the grandstand there, the ball. That was a ball diamond grandstand. It had a horse racing there in the early days. That racetrack was still there a long time. I have some air shots showing the old racetrack.
Where was that located?
Right out from Cowell. Mm-hmm. Cowell Street hits about the middle of, well, the lower end. Right
was it the other side of Weeks Field or this side? Or?
No, it was Weeks Field.
Yeah, I see. It was Weeks Field.
Yes, that's
yes,
Weeks Field.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I first hit the town here in 1944, so of course
yes.
you're still flying off of Weeks Field in those days.
Oh, yes, yes. I flew off Weeks Field 29 years. From 24 until 51 or 52. It was 29 years, and 52, I think it was, when International opened up.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a while on one little field.
Yeah, there was a lot of history made on that little field, I guess.
Oh,
for the
my
country.
Goodness, yes. Around the World Flyers, Post, Wiley Post, and Hughes, Howard Hughes, and the New York to Nome Flyers in 1920. They came first, coming up from the States. See, the Ford de Havilland with Liberty engines in them. Same type of plane that Eielson then flew experimental mail from here to McGrath, spring of 24, a couple of months before I arrived. Before I arrived in 24, June, because we.
Well, now you came in the HISO. When did you bring the HISO into Alaska?
Well, I came right with it.
Was that
Anchorage.
Your first trip to Alaska?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you'd been up here before that.
No, 24 was my first trip. I was only 25. Well, I passed my 26th birthday on the boat coming up, and the airplane was on the deck of the boat, the old Northwestern single screw boat. And our mechanic, the one from Fairbanks, who had come up, who had originally interested Jimmy Rodebaugh. Now, I'd flown for him in Rochester, Minnesota in 1922. So he knew of me, and then for the second pilot, he recommended me. And Marvin Northrop, who sold the airplanes, he was a used plane dealer in Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, just a suburb of Minneapolis. So they got me for the second airplane, and then Northrop let me know when it was ready to go, being shipped, and so I would take a passenger train to get to Seattle about the same time, and we both, the airplane and I, would get on the same boat, because they were a week apart then, once a week.
Now the airplane was not assembled at that point, was it?
No. Disassembled in Minneapolis and put aboard the freight train. Part of it was in crate, but the wings were in crate, but the fuselage was just open. So we assembled it in Anchorage. It came by rail from Seward to Anchorage. There we assembled it because they knew that Anchorage had citizens free of charge to one another, had built the field. That's the park there now.
In the middle of town?
Yeah, right in the middle of town. Yeah. It was right on the edge of 9th Street, or 10th. And that was the edge of town then, the south there.
Mm-hmm. That was the edge of town when I first went to Anchorage.
There was a homestead across, old man Gill and his family of four or five children were there, and that's where we parked the airplane. And I flew there for about a month carrying joy hoppers. It was a fine field for a Hissel Standard. It was 2,000 feet long and about 200 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
We'd been used to half-mile racetracks, which were the maximum of 1,200 feet, and not too wide, and obstructions in some of them, and we had to go around things in the States. So I'd had good practice, experience in small fields. Pick the farmers' fields or pastures all across the continent.
Would you call that barnstorming?
That's barnstorming. Uh-huh. Well, I was with the flying circus. That wasn't exactly barnstorming.
Mm-hmm.
I had three airplanes and four autopolo cars and four motorcycle riders. The motorcycle riders drove the polo cars. That was just a fun game. Supposed to be a game, you know, and they tipped the little Model T Fords over. They had steel hoops over them, stripped of the body, just a board to sit on there. And they'd roll them over by going over one another's wheels. And then turn the front wheel sharp and roll right over on that hoop. But we all had to jump. You'd be sure not get under the hoops. So, that was a lot of fun. Too exciting at times. Well, the Hissel Standard we were talking about. We flew around Anchorage for about a month, just about a month. Then we had old man Gill, who had a metal shop, mechanics shop, and a welding shop downtown Anchorage. He was selling Chevrolet cars also. We had him build a tank, a 35-gallon tank, which fit under the center section of the upper wing. That would be gravity feed into the lower tank, and it had a valve to turn on when we wanted it to run down. So we had 75 gallons capacity in the old Standard that way, and that's the only way I was able to make it nonstop from Anchorage here. 3 hours, 45 minutes. The lower tank was, if I remember right, only 35 gallons too. That means 70, only 70 gallons.
That's pretty good mileage.
Was plenty gas to get up here and make that trip. Later we sent to Lincoln, Nebraska, where the Hissel Standards were being rebuilt and assembled, and changing the front cockpit and making a little bigger airplane. They made some of them into five place, four in the front. I don't know how they did that. They moved the tank, the gas tank, I guess, a little bit. Or they just coupled them up seats up close together. Well, anyway, we sent there for a gas tank, 42-gallon tank. It was nicely built and streamlined, and it had a pump over on the top instead of on the hanging on the bottom.
I've seen pictures of the airplane with the, the tank in there. Mm-hmm.
Many of those pictures I took were with that tank.
Mm-hmm.
So I put in 6 hours, 55 minutes, nonstop, flying that tank capacity from Nome. That's after we bought one of the airplanes from Fairbanks Airplane Company and started our own company, summer of 1927. And the fellow got gangrene poisoning in his foot over there. He worked for Lohman Brothers, and his name was George Tracy. And he was in bad shape. So they asked me, or tried to get me to fly first Nome cross country, where I'd never been before, to McGrath and Takotna, and then hop to Anchorage to catch the boat to get him out to Seattle as quick as possible. Well, I flew 6 hours and 55 minutes. It was 7 hours after I had to make a turn at Takotna to let a fog bank roll over the field, a little past. It was 500 feet above the town. Maybe you've seen it.
Yeah.
So that turn put it right at 7 hours. And I expected the engine to quit because the lower tank indicator, the gas gauge, was the gauge sticking up above a little, had been showing empty, almost half an hour. So, man, I'd never done that before, you know. Here I was caught. I couldn't do anything. It was raining and low ceiling. Fog's got all over. And I found Takotna, no, Ophir. I hit Ophir first by hitting the trail from Ophir to Flats, and then turning the right way, which was to the left, to get to Ophir. Ophir had no airport then, in 1927. But they had built this little field at Takotna. And there was a road between the two places, about 15 to 20 miles, somewhere in there. And I followed that road real close. I was tickled pink to get that far, or I wouldn't be going down in the timber, 50-100 miles back out there in the mountains, see, coming straight across from Unalakleet. Oh, that would have been horrible. We'd have both been gone, I guess, if we had. And he would have died very soon because they had to amputate it here. I couldn't make Anchorage the next day because the ceiling was still low and still raining. Well, a ceiling that you could get by flying under, but rain, steady rain. And practically the whole distance to Fairbanks, it was raining. So that was the only way. I'd been through there before, to McGrath, a couple of times, once with the Fokker F3 and once with the Hissel Standard. And that was fairly flat all the way.
Where did you go from McGrath to Anchorage? You didn't go
Well, he came up to Fairbanks then.
Yeah, I know, but I mean through when
Merrill
you went across in those days.
Merrill Pass.
You went through Merrill Pass. Yeah,
always did, later on. I hadn't been through there before, then, up to then, but I flew through there many times in 31 when I flew out of Anchorage for Alaskan Airways. But I knew Fairbanks, and I knew I couldn't get through the pass. Oh, that range was tough those days. So I made Fairbanks between 4 and 5 hours, I believe. I still had headwind. The only way I could navigate through that rainy stuff coming from Caltag, the Yukon, over to Ophir was to feel the drift of the wind. I knew about where it was because of the drift and my right direction. I knew the right direction when I left the Yukon, approximately, and there I had this crosswind, northeast wind, and all the way I had to drift And that's the only compass I had. I had no compass, see?
You had no compass?
No, no compass. So I had to go by this wind drift to keep a straight course. And boy, was that tough. The little ravines and 2,000-foot mountains all through there.
And they didn't have maps in those days
No. Like
they've got now.
No. No, and it was so hard to know for sure whether you were turning at a 90-degree right angle and going. It would seem the same, you know, with rain, steady rain, no
yes,
sun.
Yes, you didn't have those little balls of bubbles up there in the instrument panel then,
no,
did you?
No, no turning bank or anything, you know. Well, I was lucky. I did a rod trail from Ophir and turned left, luckily. And I had about 20 miles, I guess, I hit Ophir. And then, well, that next morning, it was quite a job to get him out of there. He had so much pain in his foot, he had it propped up in the cockpit there, so the blood didn't come to it too strong. And I knew how much pain he was in because he hurt him so much loading him. I knew the fellow pretty well and know him too. He was their bookkeeper. He was a very fine fellow. And Dr. Romig here in Fairbanks was, Dr. Romig and Dr. Delaverne were here. But Romig, as you know, was a good pioneer doctor. And he amputated him right away, below the knee. I don't know which one, just below the knee. It was so bad. And then he recuperated a short time and then went out to Seattle. Then they amputated above the knee. So you know how soon he'd have died.
Of course.
If we had gone down. That was one of the most worrisome flights I have ever made. Because of having this poor fellow with me. Oh, I didn't like to see that. I didn't mind myself. I'd walked out in 1925 from Toplat River to Nenana in a breakup, May 5th, 6th, 7th. And the old-timers, sourdoughs around here, said that Cheechalker, Matterhorry, goes down, he is not going to get out. He's a goner because of the breakup, see? The water, deep water and deep snowdrifts all the way through. And you couldn't drink the water. And that year was a bad year for rabbits. It was a 7-year death cycle, or the that kills them off,
yeah.
See? And they get boils all over them. There were a lot of rabbits, and I had a Luger pistol, and I shot one rabbit, and I had no salt, no pans, pots, or anything. So I tried to roast it over a fire, and all it did was dripping water from the meat, see? And gee, it didn't. I tried to taste it too. I was hungry, had no food with me. And working as hard as I did, it took me 18 hours to make the first 10 miles. On the Muskeg Swamp, this side of the Toklat River, there was a foot of snow left, or better, and soft and melting. And I'd go down these holes, you know where Muskeg Swamp is?
Yeah.
It's not like what we used to call the niggerheads,
right.
Tussocks.
When you said that on the radio in that interview, I said, boy, he's changed that word, Rick.
You bet I did. I had an experience.
Yeah.
I slipped once. I had a very fine colored fellow here, and I was in, search and rescue. What's the other organization? I should remember it, but I forget my old age.
What do they call it? Civil defense.
Civil.
Not civil defense. Civil air patrol.
Civil air patrol.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's a simple name. But I was commander here of civil air patrol for 1 year, and we had a lieutenant designated in civil air patrol, and he was a colored fellow, a very fine fellow. And I slipped once telling him about this same trip, I guess, And the niggerheads were bad, I said, and boy, he got serious right away.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I said, I didn't mean to call him that. I said, Tussex, Sussex, you know.
Tussex.
I tried to excuse myself, but I could see it didn't help. I had slipped. Yeah.
And you know, there were so many words that we never thought of in the connotation of, and they were part of the vocabulary.
That's right.
That nobody made any association with an ethnic group, you know.
No, it didn't.
But anyway, so now they're Tussocks. So what happened?
Oh, let's see, where was I now?
Well, you were just roasting the rabbit, and the water ran out. And didn't taste very good.
No, I couldn't eat it at all. I knew I couldn't. It might be serious, too, because they were sick, see? The 7-year cycle takes almost all the rabbits, kills them all. Well, then I got a squirrel, and I burned that over the fire. My golly, that didn't taste very good either no salt, see? Nothing. And you couldn't roast it properly, it just burned the outside of it, and the inside was raw, see?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a grouse,
mm-hmm.
and I accidentally hit it right in the neck. And I had one shell, one cartridge left. The grouse was pretty good. I could burn that in a little ways, and the breast on those spruce ends are real good. And I like wild game, and I'm used to eating things that weren't palatable. You know, partly anyway, and I could get by on it, but boy, I was hungry. I lost 12 pounds in 3 days of walking, and I came into Nenana. Of course, they hadn't heard from me since I left Rampart, and it shows how foolish or how people or pilots can be. Here I'd flown here the summer before, 1924, all summer, but I had never gone down to Tanana or
mm-hmm.
Manly Hot Springs.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about Manly Hot Springs, but I didn't know there was a field there. 2 or 3 little farm fields
mm-hmm.
that some of them had landed on, either before or later. And here I came from Rampart. I had this 60 mile an hour headwind. I got down as far as Rampart in pretty fair shape because of the mountains from Wiseman. This was a trip to Wiseman, see, my first landing at Wiseman. And I have a picture showing me cranking the airplane at Wiseman, ready to leave. I was slim and skinny then too. I weighed 155 pounds, so I lost 12 more. Anyway, the 60 mile an hour wind from Rampart, I took off, I took on 20 gallons of gas. Well, I had taken on and what I thought should take me right through, 3 hours and a half, which it took me to go up to Wiseman from here. Well, that'll take me, I had quite a little left, and 20 gallons more, the $1 a gallon up there at that time, that was pretty reasonable. For having shipped it up there, or pulled it up by drays and horses, and so I could have taken more gas, but I wouldn't have made it anyway because from Rampart up over those hills, this side of Rampart, they're 5,000 feet. I got up in there and I was standing still, absolutely still, because I could gauge my speed.
Mm-hmm.
Heading for Brooks or Livengood.
Mm-hmm.
They had a little place to land there, but I wasn't ever going to get there because I stood still. And so I started drift sideways to get down in the flats, see if I couldn't make Nenana. And all this time, Manly Hot Springs was here, and I crossed about 10 miles on the windward side from Manly Hot Springs
mm-hmm.
and didn't know and didn't even use my head to think, well, maybe there's some place down the Tanana River
mm-hmm.
before I get to Tanana. I knew about these towns, but didn't know there were fields there. And this was the second year of flying up here, and no one had told me, and I just didn't investigate properly. Didn't expect this kind of a deal, of course. I'm going straight back surveying. So, doggone it, I was running low. I was trying so hard to get down low so I could get to Nenana, and I was making such slow time, going sideways even, see? So I got down over the cantition of the Tanana had just broken up. I couldn't land on a bar or anything there and wait, which I would have done if there'd been a bar anywhere, any spot, without nosing over. So I drifted up the Tantishna River, and then I saw the Toklat coming in there with some bars on it, but snow on the bars. It hadn't broken up yet. The Toklat hadn't broken up, the fast glacier streams. But the Tantishna was open. So I drifted down up, straight up. I was going backwards and sideways, a little backwards from a course that I was trying to make. Well, about the time I hit the Tantishna, my oil pressure was going down. Go down, and then I'd pull the nose up, and that would put a little oil back in the pump. And the pressure would go up again. So I'd nose down and get a little speed and go right down to zero again. So I didn't dare to fly very long that way, so I'd pull the nose up again. I kept doing that for about 10 miles. And I knew that sooner or later it wouldn't be getting enough oil because it was using oil right along. I hadn't put oil in at Rampart, but I'd put the 20 gallons of gas in. And the oil goes into the crankcase on those hissos. So, and the tank gauge was down. I knew I couldn't get anywhere anyway, so I might as well land. And then there were some lakes in the flats there. The snow was mostly gone, been beautiful landings. But I knew that they would break up in a short time and they would lose the airplane if I didn't get out, or if I got out, maybe we would lose the airplane before I could get back there with the other Hissel Standard or the OX-5 Jenny, which we had here. So, I landed on the bar in about a foot of soft, melting snow, and I hit a piece of driftwood with one wheel, and I hit from the upper part of the tree where the roots goes out this way. It went to the right anyway, and the wheel pulled out over this part of the root. I was just about stopped. Of course, I landed quite slow, but there wasn't much wind on the ground right there at the landing. But it broke a cross wire and dropped the lower wing down on the snow. And that's, of course, where I had to leave it.
Whereabouts was it exactly? Was it on the Tananor or on the...
No, on the Toklat.
Oh, yeah.
Toklat River, about 10 miles, not quite 10 miles, airline up from the mouth of the Toklat where it empties in the Kantishna.
Oh, yeah.
So I started... I stayed in the airplane that night. I had one bun left. I'd had two or three buns from Fairbanks. And I ate one, I believe, during the day after I left Wiseman. You see, I'd flown up that day and had dinner, and they made me an honorary member of the Pioneers, Igloo number 4. No, Igloo number 8. 4 is here. Igloo number 8. So they insisted on making me an honorary member and gave me a pin put on the left lapel and a nice dinner. And I was so anxious to get back, you know, I wanted to make a round trip. Pretty good time, see? And I didn't realize coming up that I'd had this mostly tail wind 3 hours and a half, I think it was. 3 hours, 20 minutes. Well, that's good time. That'll take about the same to go back, according to distance, and 60 miles an hour. Well, that was a different story when I started south, I had a quartering headwind going all the way to Rampart. And I was 3 hours and something, I forgot what, 40 minutes, to Rampart. And I said, gee, that's quite a wind. But landed down there on the ice, on the Yukon, in an empty, kind of a smooth spot. The snow was gone. Mm-hmm. I could see the blue ice. Mm-hmm. So I had no trouble landing about a quarter mile below the town of Rampart. And there was a Japanese store owner there. He came down right away, and of course I wanted gas, but I didn't know I wanted oil. Mm-hmm. I didn't think. Inexperience. Oh, sure, he says, we got case gas. Put 20 gallons in. And I thought maybe I'd make the same speed going to Livengood. But there I was straight head on into it from Rampart House going into the northeast more.
You were going backwards more than forwards.
Yeah, from town of Rampart, yeah. Boy, I've never stood still before in my life, but that time, that was better than 60 miles an hour at that altitude, see? Mm. But if I had used my head, I could have gone right down the Yukon River from Rampart to Tanana.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the telephone system, well, they had telephone, overland telephone from Rampart. So Fairbanks knew when I took off from Rampart and wasn't heard from again. And Manly Hot Springs had telephone and Tanana. Mm-hmm. And they knew I was down somewhere because I didn't report anywhere. Yeah. Boy, oh boy, some deal. And I'd had a nice tailwind to down the Yukon to Tanana. And there, the parade ground. The parade grounds is where they landed many times. I think Eielson landed there.
Well, what did you do with the one bun after you spent the night in the airplane on the tow clap?
I had it the next morning before the start of my
and
walk.
Then you, and how far was it then into Nenana then? About
40 miles airline.
40 miles.
I've measured it on the map many times. But I think I made close to 80 miles because of going around all these swamps full of water. Oh, deep water. I didn't want to get wet too far up, but I was wet above the knees all the time in the snow, crawling some drifts.
And cold. It wasn't warm.
Well, it was thawing every day, which helped some, and lots of daylight. So I try to lay down with these wet, oh well, up above my knees and full of, my boots were leather boots up to here, and they were full of water all the time. And I'd take them off and wring out my socks and do a little, but the boots were
soaking
wet,
wet,
solid wet. So I couldn't sleep because there was hardly a dry spot, even up against spruce trees, where I could lay down without getting water through my clothes. And another thing that was so tough was these burnt spruces. They burn and bend over, mm-hmm, and touch the ground on the tops. Mm-hmm. They seemed to be crosswise on my path everywhere, so I was having to step on them, break them down, and around some of them. It was zigzag just like this all the way.
Rough going.
Yes. But the first 10 miles, I hit a stream, a slow running, it wasn't glacier stream, it was a slow running stream off the towclad, but it leveled off, so it was slow running. And it had some big spruce trees along the river. That was about 8 miles from the towclad, not quite maybe. 5 miles anyway after crossing this muskeg swamp. And you know, I'd been running around this racetrack out here jogging 3 miles every night, almost every night, because I knew sometime I was going down somewhere. So I wanted to keep in practice, and I ate the best foods, and I didn't drink or smoke or carouse around any, and I wanted to stay in shape because I knew I'd die if I didn't keep in shape. So I thought I was in perfect shape. I could run from now on, a jog, as far as I wanted. I'd go 3 miles around the track. Well, the first hour, I managed to struggle for an hour. And finally, I played out so badly that I couldn't have wiggled if a bear had been coming around. I could hardly have turned around. I was so all in from these going down these holes and snow, and I was pulling my legs up this way, you see, over the snow, because of sinking in the muskeg. Muskeg is a swampy stuff. It's not like tussocks, but almost as bad, with snow on top.
Yeah.
In the summer, if the snow was gone, it wouldn't have been so bad. It wouldn't have that all that to get over, see? I played out so completely, you can't imagine. And I'll never, never forget it. I had to lay down and rest. I let it rest for half an hour. Then I'd go another hour and play out the same way. But before I got to this slough, I was gaining in strength. You do that, see if your body will take it, see? If you're healthy, in other words, you gain for extreme exercise, see? Well, I hadn't had that extreme exercise before, and that takes you quick. Well, I thought, this is awful. Get through here. I don't know whether I'm going to make it or not. But you know, I got to that hill. They call it Wien Lookout now on some of the maps. It's 1,000 feet up, but long slopes on all sides. Almost a direct course, not quite a direct course to McGrath, out of Nenana.
Yeah.
You can see it from Nenana. So I got up there where I could see Nenana over this way and where it was. I wanted to get somewhere where I could see the hills at Nenana. I knew where I was then. So I rested. I rested there. That was my first rest, 18 hours. The hardest work I ever did in my life. At first, exercising. Well, the next 2 days weren't quite so bad, but almost as bad. I had no food and I was hungry. And this eating of wild game burnt wasn't good. I didn't get enough. So I kept losing, of course. Now they did a road trail. Oh, first I'll say, if I had crossed the Toklat River, I landed on the west side, and then I crossed the river because it was just a slow stream among ice breaking on the sides. I had no trouble there, but I got my boots full going across there too. But here was a trail along that side of the river. Now this was an Indian trail, natives, from the mouth of Toklat up to Knight's Roadhouse, which was right on the mail trail. The Nenana McGrath mail trail. That was 12 miles up the river. I didn't know about that, see? And I didn't think, I thought this was a game trail, a moose, caribou, and bear or something trail. It didn't look too well worn because they didn't use it much. So I didn't follow that up. I didn't want to waste any time away from Nenana. That was right angles, see, from Nenana. So I struck out cross country. I got better exercise. If I'd only... And there were people living there then, because the mail had been going by dog team. And
you were 2 years in the country, but still a little bit of a chichaco.
I sure was. I was a chichaco, all right. And if I hadn't been a Minnesota farm boy with lots of hard work and good food.
That's
proper
true.
Food,
that's
I
true.
Meant to say.
Sure.
Just simple food.
Healthy.
So I had a good body to begin with. Otherwise, it was impossible. You know, if it's been
that was probably a terrible experience at the time. It's an adventure to look back on it, but
it was
survival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I got into Nenana. First, I got to the Nenana River. Well, I had to build a raft across another low, slow stream. But first, I'll say that first stream that I crossed, slow running near the Toklat. I had a little axe that long, one of these little Boy Scout axes, mm-hmm. and I carried that with me for wood and emergency. And I chopped a tree, the butt of it was that big, and it took me 2 hours to chop that on both sides. I'd cut a lot of wood in Minnesota, so I knew how to fell a tree. It was just right, but it fell in the quite high bank, about 6-7 feet banks, and the tree reached across this little slough or slow running river, but the butt went down way down the bank, and then the rest of it bent into the water this way, and it didn't have many branches quite a ways up or about the middle of the stream. There were very few, if any, branches, just little sticks like this, you know, dried stuff on it, and I had to walk this because it was deep. I didn't want to get wet all over because I'd have gotten chilled, and I might not have made it then. Ice water is what it was. Well, I managed to reach down and hold a little bit and then get across, but I was down the water, walking in the water on this spruce. Well, I made it across there without getting wet all over. Then the next time was about 30 miles farther on, another small stream where the dog teams had been crossing. They weren't running now, you see, because mm-hmm. the stream was open. Well, there was a gas case, old gas case there, and I had this little axe, and it had a place to pull nails on the mm-hmm. side of it, if you remember. And I took the nails out and the pieces of box, and some just happened to be some 4-foot pieces of wood that they had sawed there for something or another. They've been running mail there a long time, you see. And I nailed these pieces together with the boards and those thin box, gas case box nails. Well, I gave it a shove. It was about 12 feet across, something like that, of water, deep water. And I gave it a shove. I don't remember, I had a stick of some kind that I paddled a little bit with. But you know, just as I got to the shore, it fell all apart. Because those small nails in the mm-hmm. fairly rotten pieces of wood mm-hmm. didn't hold very well, see? And
my,
I just got down in the water a little bit like I had been before, but mm-hmm. got to the bank. Well, that wasn't bad. That was pretty good.
You made it almost. Yeah. Didn't get too
wet. Then the Nenana River. That's a big river.
Mm-hmm.
Fast running, it had broken up and the ice cakes were coming down, but on this side, the side I was on, that's the west side, was a little cabin, and I saw smoke coming out of the chimney, the stovepipe. Then I looked across the river and here was an old man going in his boat between the cakes. He was going over, what he was doing, he was going to feed his dogs on the other side. And I went to the bank and hollered loud as I could. I guess I couldn't holler too loud or something.
At that point you were probably a little...
You know, he either saw me or he heard me, and he fed his dogs and came right back. Then he fixed me a bowl of clam chowder soup in his little cabin. That was the best tasting food I have ever tasted.
Of course.
Clam chowder, man, it was good. Then he took me over again, took me over across. I had to cross this river to get to Nenana. Then I was okay, and I paid him $5, I remember. I had some money in my pocket. Paid him $5 for the extra trip over. Well, he seemed pleased. But I don't remember whether he had heard anything about me being missing or not, but I think he had, going to Ninan, I think. Well, I went to a restaurant. I hadn't had enough to eat yet, see, so I went to a restaurant, had some food. I think it was ham and eggs, which I'd been thinking about. And I fell. And then I went to the little hotel there. And, of course, they didn't know me. I was kind of dirty and whiskery. And they didn't know me at all, the guy behind the counter. And I signed my name, and he pulled it around. And he said, you're that guy that's missing. Say, you've got to call Fairbanks right away, he said. They had orders if they should see me, or if I should come in there accidentally for no reason, be sure and call, which I did. And then I was going to bed and sleep first. But no, he says, you can't do that. You've got to call right now. I promised. I forget who he was. I knew him later, too, pretty well. Nice fellow. Well, the train had gone through the day before, I believe, but there was a motor-driven hand car, a little single-engine hand car, the next day going to Fairbanks. So I rode the hand car, but I had just a leather jacket on me because I left my flying suit in the airplane.
And that's when you got cold.
That's when I got real cold. Sitting there, I forgot how many hours.
Sure.
In a breeze, you see, and gee, I got cold. And of course, from being wet, I already had a bad throat cold, you see. And then this, it was pretty bad. I had the thing. But you know, the next day after I got in, I took Ed Young, who had just come in. Have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
He was killed at Livengood later in a Fairchild 71 with Alaskan Airways. That's now Pan American. And I went over there and picked up the bodies with their ship because their pilots didn't want to go over. Felt so bad about it. Well, anyway, Ed Young, they assembled the Jenny, OH-5 Jenny.
Keep talking. I'll be right back.
And Ed Young had test hopped it, and he'd landed in the middle part of Weeks Field, mm-hmm. where the low spot is, and in the spring it's always soft.
Mm-hmm.
And he nosed over and broke the prop. Well, they should have known enough to tell him to be sure and land on this side near the hangars, which was dry and hard. But he didn't anyway. He was going to Livengood to look for me out of there. And he didn't get there because I called into Ninana before he got off again. But the airplane was there ready to go. So the next day after I got in from Ninana on that handcar, we took off, Ed Young and I. I flew the Jenny because I knew where the airplane was.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew over it, right direct from Fairbanks, and could see the river had broken up. And I could see that the wing was covered with sand, that lower wing. It's a fast stream, and it broke up fast, and it came down fast. And we went back, but I had landed Ninana to gas up, because we carried only 20 gallons, and the Jenny wasn't too fast either, so mm-hmm. 2 hours flying is all you could get out of them. That wasn't enough to come all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was almost an hour and a half getting over there and circling some. So we let Nenana gassed up and came back on in. That was the next day after I got in.
Hmm.
Then I went to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my.
For 10-12 days or something like that. At Nardale, where I was had a room. Recuperating a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I had an awful bad, one of those sore, biting throats.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't really safely go out anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
No, they catch up with you every now and then. My, that was an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, well, it sure was.
You didn't go down very many times.
No, didn't. Didn't. I learned fast.
After that.
Yeah. Boy. If I'd only rested at Wiseman overnight, it might have been a little better the next day.
Of course.
I didn't feel any wind in the flats the next day. Although it didn't seem to be too much then either, but just above the ground, 200 feet above the ground where I'd have to fly.
Now, I'm curious about something. As a result of that experience, did you consider alternate routes or think of mapping the country at all? Or did it have any effect on you?
Well, I wasn't interested in mapping, although I remarked the maps. That's the best I could do. We were using the sectional road commission maps. They were kind of a blue map. The only other map we had of all Alaska was 1915, either Kroll's or the other big company, I forgot which. And it didn't do much good. See, there was a big map like that didn't show the towns and places. I know Beaver over here on the Yukon was always 15 miles from where it should be,
mm-hmm.
from Fort Yukon.
Hmm.
Well, when you made that first trip from here over to Nome, had you been over to Nome before?
No.
You had?
No.
Well, I first went to Nome in 1944, and I flew out of there for Alaska Airlines from 44 to 58.
Oh.
So I was over there when Sig was still there.
You were.
See? He was flying that old Blanca. Most of the time over there, and so Hank Miller was over there then, and you know, some of the old fellas.
Yes.
But anyhow, I just wondered, we used to make a lot of flights back at that time with a lot of unreliable engines, like the old Wasp C and the Travelairs and the old Wright 330.
Yeah.
That Hisso that you were talking about kind of reminded me of that old 330. It had a pressure relief valve in the oil system that used to get a little fleck of carbon or something under it every now and then, and it would lose its oil pressure. So there was only one thing to do. Usually if it was wintertime, the pilot would land on skis wherever he could land and get out, and he'd back that pressure relief valve off and get that piece of carbon out from under there and screw it back to where it was before and get in, crank it up, and away you'd go.
Oh, yes.
And, kind of like that. But I got to thinking when I read about that flight from Fairbanks to Nome, I know that in those days a lot of the pilots, like Frank Whaley and all, you know, used to follow the Yukon as far as we could go. And a lot of times, if we were going to Nome, we'd have to go all the way to Unalakleet, come across to Caltech, and follow the river all the way up. Now, how did you go from here?
With the Fokker, I went straight across from New Lato, across the hill, because it was clear.
I see.
And I had a map showing Norton Bay on the other side and about where to hit it, and it worked fine that way.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I got to New Lato area, or took off after repairing the airplane, after our nose over at Ruby, new prop, the crankshaft been bent a little bit from breaking the first propeller. Went clear over on her back.
Oh boy.
There. Had no airport there. And I landed on the Ball Diamond right up from Ruby to the east of Ruby, right up the hill.
I see.
And I could see that pretty good from the air, of course, but it was rounding all the way, and here in the center was a little flat area and a little bit of hollow, and that's where the frost hadn't, well, the frost had gone out, and it was soft and wet in there,
mm-hmm.
and very soft, and I hit that. The tires on the old Fokker were quite large, too, mm-hmm. but it went right down into them, and over mm-hmm. we went. The Fokker was light on the tail, because
mm-hmm.
it had no brakes. I could lift it with one hand and put my shoulder under the stabilizer and turn that ship around easy,
mm-hmm.
which you couldn't do later ships that had brakes on. They were heavy. But we went clear over in the back and bent the prop. Dick Wood, the banker here, and he was president of the airplane company at that time, Fairbanks Airplane Company,